start that. I didn't need correcting.
Shut up! Order!
Order! Let's start off as we need to go on.
We can see a better future.
So it's not a competition who can shout the loudest.
Hello, I'm Brandon, and you're listening to the Left Wingers podcast. We are an unashamedly left-wing political podcast made by activists for activists.
Welcome to another episode of Winging Wednesday. Every Winging Wednesday, we'll be giving you our hot takes on the week's news stories, playing games, and responding to what you, our listeners, have to say.
In today's episode, we're going to discuss the short-term solutions to the energy crisis, or at least what we think could be the short-term solutions. We talked about this issue a few weeks ago in an episode, but we didn't really focus on solutions. We were more kind of looking at the problem. If you want to listen to that episode, it's going to be linked in our episode description. Anyway, for this episode today, we asked you, our listeners, for your ideas, and these will supplement our conversation. That's going to come later in the episode.
So I have to feel like we need to start our conversation on something very topical. And this is quite emotional, but I think it's fair to say that this episode is going out on Wednesday, and we have recorded it the day before. And one of the things that we all saw today was President Zelensky address the UK Parliament and the House of Commons. So as many of you might know, I work in politics, and I'm lucky enough to work for an MP who allowed me today to go and stand in the public gallery and to watch Zelensky address the MPs. And I felt the need to come on and talk about it, because if you haven't seen it, I'm sure you can find it on BBC Parliament. I'm sure you can find it on the news. I'm sure it'd be very well covered. But I think that we spoke about this previously before recording this episode. We all said that this needed to be talked about, because I think it was an exceptionally brave speech. And I think it's probably very difficult for somebody to address so many people virtually. Which, you know, that's never happened in Commons history. That's, you know, there's never been screens coming in before. I think that was a really controversial decision, actually. I'm not too sure whether they should have done it, but I'm happy that they did, I guess. It was important for him to talk to us. And I think in the age in which we live now, that's really, really powerful. And Zelensky essentially got an opportunity to address the lawmakers of this country and as well the people of this country. And I think he did both those things very well. I have to say, just from standing in the public gallery, everyone in all sides of the house was exceptionally supportive of Zelensky and what he had to say. I personally found it very moving and very emotional. I think this might be one of the last times that he's kind of seen in public or addressed people in public. And I think that kind of unfortunately stood out to everyone who was watching. He was quite clear in his calls, and he praised the UK for what we had done, but said there was more to be done and encouraged us to keep up the pressure. And one of the things that I found it quite emotional was he talked about this infamous Churchill speech, the kind of never surrender and we'll fight them. And he said, you know, they had a decision whether they should to be or not to be as Ukrainians. And they decided that they were going to be. And I thought that was, you know, very, very moving. Yeah, I really felt like, please go and watch that, because that is live history. That is the first version of history that has been put, and anyone with a phone or a TV can see it. So I would really recommend it. And I would say, actually, there's a man, I think he, correct me if I'm wrong, Brandon, but I think he started off as a comedian and then became a politician. So I don't think any of this was planned, you know, for him, from his perspective, none of this was planned. But even, you know, he didn't speak in English. He spoke in another language and it was translated. But even so, it was, you know, the meaning was completely there, and he addressed it live. And I really thought that was something that we had to speak about. And yes, there will be more positive points on this podcast and we keep it jovial, but in times of crisis, and I think this Ukrainian conflict, you know, it's pretty terrible and tragic what Putin has decided to do to the country of Ukraine. I think we have to discuss it. There's no way we can't.
Yeah, I found it really interesting, his kind of appeals to British history in his speech. You know, he definitely knew his audience. It was really a call to action. Sure. He obviously complimented the UK and the British government on how they've responded to the crisis so far. But it was kind of an appeal for further support for an increase in sanctions. He didn't say it explicitly, as far as I can remember, but he did hint at the idea of a no-fly zone, which he has called for in the past. But yeah, he I think the most powerful bit of his speech probably was his paraphrasing of Churchill. He said, "We will not surrender, we will fight to the end, at sea, in the air, in the forests, in the fields, and in the streets. We will fight whatever the cost." And that's, you know, that's a speech that I'm personally very familiar with. I know a lot of people will be very familiar with that, that original Churchill speech. And yeah, it kind of, it was a moment where history was definitely being made. I envy the fact that you could go in and watch the speech as it happened.
We were, honestly, we were so lucky. So we asked, me and a colleague asked one of the officers if we could go and watch it, and they said no. And we said, well, if we turn up, do you reckon there's a chance if people don't turn up? Because obviously preference is given to members of the House of Lords who want to watch it first. And we just snuck in. And I think if we had been there 2 minutes later, we wouldn't have got in. It sounds really cheesy, I know, but I really felt like it was a privilege to hear him. To hear him speak, because we might not have that opportunity again. I think we've seen a lot on both sides of the conflict, on Putin's side and on Zelensky's side, like social media and the ability to use cameras and video to communicate, I think has made this so different to every other conflict that we've seen. And I, you know, whether that's like propaganda videos, whether that's how they speak, whether that's the memes that they use, for example, you know, I just think that was quite amazing, and that was something that I've definitely reflected on.
Okay, so we teased it at the start of the episode, but I think now is the right time to move on to our next discussion topic, which is how we deal with the cost of living crisis, at least in the short term. Now, in future episodes, we might look at more long-term solutions to the crisis and how we can build our economy to be stronger against global economic shocks and global price rises. But we're really focusing down today on those short-term solutions, of which I think actually quite a few of them have been now either implemented by the government or the Labour Party's kind of put them forward as an alternative. But we thought it was worth kind of asking you, our listeners, for your ideas about what you would like to see the government do in terms of tackling the cost of living crisis. And we're going to have a little bit of a chat about them. Okay, so I apologise in advance if I butcher this username. And I think it's Edemion98, E-D-Y-M-I-O-N 98 on Twitter, has said compulsory purchase of luxury blocks in London / municipalization. What do you think? Do you think that's a viable solution? Do you think it's something that could happen? Do you think it would actually help to tackle the cost of living crisis?
I think what is probably a good way of tying it into what we talked to previously is the fact that you could use it as a punishment for Russian oligarchs and Russian corrupt businessmen who are currently occupying vast amounts of property in London and oftentimes leaving it empty as a good way of raising funds, especially within London. And obviously that could then be put towards local schemes helping out those most in need, and it's a good way of raising money for this crisis that we obviously have in terms of energy, but also building on those sanctions that the UK has been putting forward but, as Labour have argued, have not gone far enough.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that. I don't think that that's going to solve the country's cost of living crisis, which I think, you know, I know we've mentioned this before, but I think it's worth saying again, we have an energy crisis, a cost of living crisis. Ukraine was a huge breadbasket for the world. I think the price of wheat and bread will go up. There is inflation. You know, it's going to be very difficult. So I'm not too sure that strategy will be successful. However, I do think that there should be the tightest and harshest sanctions for Russian oligarchs or Russian businessmen or shell companies or whoever it is has decided, you know, has bought 2 million, 10 million, 50 million properties in Notting Hill or Kensington or anywhere like that. So I think we should do it to send the message that it's, you know, times have changed and it's not acceptable anymore. However, I'm not too sure it will solve anything. I'd quite like to see an image, just for image reasons, I'd love to see some Ukrainian refugees be put in those empty homes, because you know, if we want to take in refugees, which I think we should, they're going to need somewhere to live. So,
yeah, I think the benefit of this comment that we've got sent in is that it really shows that it kind of reminds us that to tackle the cost of living crisis, we need a multi-pronged attack. And, you know, the obvious kind of area for looking at reducing prices is with energy, but also rents being extraordinarily high at the moment is what's really making this cost of living crisis even worse than it would be anyway. And, you know, I am not a Londoner, but I understand from obviously you, Kathleen, and people that I know who live in London, how much of your income is taken up by renting alone. And if this could go some of the way towards tackling rent levels in London and in the large cities, because the specific comment says London, but really in any large city, then, you know, that's one step towards having lower cost for ordinary people. And I think that's a good thing in and of itself.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's well picked up there. I mean, I think that comes along to maybe another point that someone else has raised, which is to freeze tax levels, or just to have a year where we freeze everything at its current price, just for a little bit of time, so people can deal with what will come later, which I think was mentioned by somebody else as well.
Okay, so talking of a multi-pronged attack, Craig Dawson on Twitter said, boost work pay and collective bargaining. There needs to be a bonfire of trade union red tape, and that would be a good place to start. And I think as a podcast, you know, we believe in raising the wage of workers. I think we're generally all in agreement that collective bargaining is the way forward. And I think that as well as pushing down prices, we obviously need to raise incomes as well. And I think that's part of that multi-pronged attack. And to be honest, whether we had a cost of living crisis or not, I think it was time to have a bonfire of trade union red tape anyway. But given the situation, it's a good excuse to go hard and fast. Not that I expect the government to do this by any stretch of the imagination, but we are a left-wing podcast. We are presenting an alternative. And I think if we were the current cabinet, God forbid, that might be something.
What do you mean,
that...
God forbid?
It can't be much worse, can it? Surely.
Well,
hang on, chaps. What do you mean, God forbid? Explain yourself.
I like to think that'd be quite sensible on the podcast. But yeah.
Believe in yourself, Brandon.
Of course. What do you think
back
about
to,
that?
That's union stuff. I think in itself, if we had high levels of union membership in this country, it probably would be a very good idea. And if we still had a bit more liaison with trade unions within private companies, it would be a very good idea. But at the moment, I think the issue is not that necessarily that trade union red tape will solve it. It will help maybe 27% of workers who are in a union. But the problem is, I find that it's still, a union is still a far away sort of abstract concept to a lot of workers, especially in the gig economy and in private sector businesses. So it's, if we can do the red tape busting, as Craig Dawson has said, along as bringing together people into these unions, and that'll probably be a better approach than just doing the cutting of the red tape.
So I think boosting worker pay is always a good idea. I think it's, as Brandon said, one of the prongs that the government can use. I'd also be interested to see what the government is going to do about this, because we're kind of rumbling ever closer to the tax hike, to the national insurance hike in April. Energy prices are on the way up. This is a crisis that we spoke about a few episodes ago, but I feel like the government haven't said or done anything. And I'm going to be really interested to see if they pull something out of the Queen's speech or a budget or some other time in the next 6 weeks. But bearing in mind, there's only a really couple of weeks left until this really starts to hit our pockets. So I'd be fascinated to see what they come up with. Always on the side of unions, always pro young people joining unions. If you are listening to this and you haven't joined a union, do yourself a favor, give yourself a present. Happy Wednesday, join a union. Always a great idea. You'll love it, I promise. I always think the bonfire of trade union red tape is always, while it's important to workers, I find it to be such a political issue. And people, I think, vote on the side of whether they like the concept of trade unions without actually looking at what the red tape is.
Yeah, and if I remember when we put this episode out, in the episode description, there should be the TUC's join a union. It's a calculator. It basically tells you, based on your industry, based on your sector, what trade union you should join. And if you're not sure where to start in terms of joining a trade union, what the benefits are to you, the Trade Union Congress website is a great resource to actually look and see what benefits trade unions offer. I think, Ashan, what you raise about the majority of workers who are part of trade unions being in the public sector, that's something that really needs to change. And I think only when we have a government which is not actively hostile to trade unions will we potentially see a growth in, not saying that we have to have pro trade union government to see growth in trade union membership, but I think if we had a government which was more pro trade union, we could see a growth in membership in the private sector and gig economy, especially if it was accompanied by cutting a lot of the restrictions on trade unions which are currently in place and have being put in place by the last few Conservative governments.
I do think, though, on that you can't... You're right that we can't depend on the government to make unions more fashionable, but it does also have to come down to maybe... I know there's a load of great young and older trade unionists doing great work trying to recruit people, trying to organise in branches in workplaces, but there is also needs to be a change in maybe... outlook for a lot of these unions to maybe reach into new cultures and new areas that they haven't reached before, particularly as we move into a more tech-focused, increasingly gig-focused economy. They must also change. They can't use the old tactics in a new world as well, whereas they have their place. But I also do feel it's onus on a wider group of people rather than just the government. I feel bad. I'm not bashing unions.
No, because you're right. You're completely correct.
You speak to most people and they're like, why would I join a union? It doesn't affect me. And it's like, yeah, you have a point, because some of the unions
people
are
think like student unions and people think like, and I yeah,
yeah. Not. And like a lot of them, especially older people, their only view of a union is just shouting on a picket, when it's a lot of times a bit more
when actually 90% of it is not
exactly.
So when we put out this question on our group, our WhatsApp, I basically said, right, everybody chuck your ideas on there. And we all came up with variations of what Labour's policy is at the moment on tackling the energy crisis, in terms of don't have national insurance hike, because that's just another cost. And also getting rid of VAT on energy. It just seems like a common sense solution. Not really sure what the government's playing at in terms of not committing to abolish that. I'm hoping that it's going to be some kind of last minute surprise. I wouldn't put it past the government, to be honest, because I think they're worried about their reputation as being, and I put this in massive, massive quote marks, the party that looks after the economy better. And I think they're really worried about that. And I wouldn't be surprised if they did come out with something at the last minute and say, actually, we're going to slash VAT and we're going to, I do expect it to happen, but it's the most direct way, I think, of all of the things which have been put forward in this episode, that you could actually tackle energy prices, which is the main source of the cost of living crisis at the moment. What do you two think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the classic Johnson government to let a problem fester for as long as possible. And then just before it gets to a stage where it's actually really, really terrible, pop out a little solution that you've been baking up in number 10 and 11. So I think that might be the case. Or sometimes I think that they just wait to see how big of a deal it gets, and if the papers don't report on it enough, they kind of just leave it. I mean, to be realistic, the government will have to come up with something, and it's got to be something good, because inflation's at a 30-year high. I just have never seen a mix of economic problems like this, and I think especially after COVID, it's just like, it just seemed for working people, it just seems like one hit after another. And I just very worried about what will come in the next 6 to 9 months. We have a lot of people at the minute in the UK who are what Theresa May would call the jams, which is the just about managing. And I feel like they might slide into poverty and then other people as well, and that's really horrible to see.
I think it does also boil down to, I think you mentioned it, the short-termism of conservative governments over the last 12 years. I mean, people call it a lost decade, and the reason it is because although they've had all these slogans of just about managing, build back better or whatever, insert irrelevant Tory slogan here, they've all been hot air, and every time it's come to a budget or every time it's come to a election pledge, it's just been, we'll fix it with one short, sharp tax cut or one short, sharp policy review or inquiry, whereas there's not been any sort of ambition for the nation, and that is all culminating now with a sort of COVID backlash and all the economic issues that we're seeing. And it's up to Labour, I suppose, and other left-wing activists to come up with and put forward an ambitious agenda for the country.
But I mean, I agree with you, but I feel like there's only so many rabbits you can pull out of a hat.
But that's also the problem, isn't it?
But he's pulled out quite a lot so far in the past 2 years, and I really question, like, what else is in the hat? Like, I feel like even Mary Poppins has, like, less things in her bag. Like, I'm really curious to see, like, how is he going to sort this out? Like, as I said, from a policy perspective, it's absolutely fascinating. But as somebody who is a worker, I'm very, very concerned for what the next 6 months will bring for me, for my family, and for the people that I know. It's definitely, there will be challenging financial times ahead. I'm pretty sure of it.
Yeah, I think that is the big question, what he does next, because the Tories have run out of ideas, it seems.
Well, we'll find out, and I guess we'll be covering it on the Left Wingers either way. I think there's a lot going on in the next, there's no doubt about it, the news is very much happening, so we'll be covering it all here, and you can listen to us on a weekly basis, and we'll tell you exactly what the news is and our best analysis on what has happened.
All I can say is that the government's current plans to tackle the cost of living crisis are inadequate. At the most generous,
non-existent kind of
non-existent is what I would call it. Well, not non-existent, entirely entirely misdirected in terms of the one kind of flagship policy on this has been the loans, essentially, to try and tackle the people's ability to spend money on their energy, which is completely bizarre. Don't know what the justification for that is. It's just fascinating to me that, you know, that we've talked about all these solutions today, and maybe some of them aren't as easy to implement as what we think sat here in our various rooms, but there just seems to be a complete lack of imagination. The only solutions which the government's coming out with will end up costing working people more in the long term, and I just don't understand where they're going with this, because I don't think this is a crisis which is going to peter away in the next year. And we're suddenly, you know, 2023, we're not going to hear about it again. I see a lot of things culminating into big economic times of woe. Like, I don't see how... Sorry, this sounds so...
Certainly is the roaring 20s, isn't it, guys?
The roaring 20s, what a time to be alive. I just don't see how this can get better without significant intervention, not just from the UK government, to be fair, but international governments. We need a response like what happened in 2008 to try and mitigate the worst of what is, you know, a UK crisis, the UK cost of living crisis, but also in terms of like inflationary pressures and balance of trade and international crisis as well.
And of course, if you're listening to this podcast and you're screaming out loud or tweeting furiously, Kathleen, Brandon and Ashan, you've got this wrong. The best thing we can do is insert your solution here. Get in touch with us and let us know, because we'd love to hear what you think, and we'll, if there are any particularly great ones that we haven't covered, we will definitely read them out in future episodes, and we desperately want to hear what you think.
Although at the moment that's unfortunately all we've got time for today. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Whinging Wednesday. We'll be back next Whinging Wednesday with a new episode. And if you're interested in hearing our thoughts about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, check out our most recent episode where we discuss whether it is right to prescribe RT News and other Russian news outlets, and how the government's responded to this crisis in terms of putting cultural sanctions on the Russian government.
If you enjoy listening to us, please subscribe to this podcast to be notified when our new episodes come out. We also have a mailing list called the Left Wingers Community, which you can join using the link in this episode's description. Likewise, you can keep in contact with us using the links in our social media, which are also in the description. Please reach out. We'd love to hear from you, and we love to hear from our listeners. You guys are really fantastic.
Keep whinging, and we'll see you soon.